Case number 21-2684, Tiffany Savoy et al. Versus City of East Lansing, Michigan et al. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Puget for the appellants.
If it pleases the court, Your Honor's esteemed panel, my name is Andrew Puget for the appellant Tiffany Savoy and Natalie Page Louise Hooper versus Adam Park, Matthew Swab, Jeff Murphy, City of East Lansing, and Jane Doe. It's my privilege and honor to announce that this is my first opportunity to speak in front of the Sixth Circuit Appellate Court, so I will proceed. This case is on appeal from a final order of dismissal at the pleading level. While the complaint in this case had multiple counts, in all those cases they arise fairly from 42 U.S.C. 1983, which of course this panel understands and is very familiar with. It allows a U.S. citizen to bring a federal action against state actors who violate federally protected rights of life, liberty, and property. Of course, most of these causes of actions are situated around excessive force allegations, false imprisonment allegations, and malicious prosecution allegations. This case is not much different. I will stress, if I can at all, to this court that the framework of this appeal is both in the form of a 1983 case, such that the plaintiffs are U.S. citizens trying to go to force a state actor, in this case law enforcement officers, to defend their alleged unconstitutional violations on the merits. And in addition to that, the additional framework that I would provide for this appeal is that this is not a case where the matter was dismissed by 12b-5 standards, where there was a ineffective attempt at service of process. This is not a case where service of process was half-heartedly attempted, but in fact this is a case where service of process was timely and officially obtained, and that later on the court determined that that service of process was defective.
But you served the wrong person, right? For the vis-a-vis the three individuals, or at least Park and Swab, did you not serve the wrong person?
The person that was served was, at the time, the chief law enforcement officer for the City of East Lansing. The reason I say chief as opposed to deputy chief is because it's in the appellee's brief. They actually do mention in footnote 8 that the actual interim chief was not actually an employee at the time. And so the deputy chief, Mr. Gonzalez, who was served, in fact, would be the acting.
But what law or provision allows you to serve the chief or deputy chief instead of serving Park and Swab themselves?
Excellent question, Your Honor. I would suggest that both MCR Rule 2.105G, which talks about municipalities, public corporations.
But they are not municipalities. They are officers. They're people. They're not the public entity. And doesn't G apply only to a public entity?
Well, I would suggest the City of East Lansing Police Department was inherently defendant to the extent that these defendants were being charged both in their individual capacities and in their official capacities. Failing that 2.105G argument, certainly the trial court did entertain and discuss the service of process sufficiency based upon an agent in fact. And I would suggest that the very first analysis that must be brought based upon the 12b-5 dismissal is whether in fact a service of process was effective. And I would argue respectfully that service of process was effective to the extent that the only competent evidence, sufficient and competent evidence presented before the trial court at the time of the 12b-5 hearing was in fact a return of service which was signed and sworn by the person appointed and capable of doing service of process, the process server. And it was also signed by the deputy chief justice, which in this time, I would say, again, was the chief law enforcement officer at the time. So the only competent evidence before the court that wasn't just an unverified motion filed by attorneys who did very good work but didn't allege or even allege to have firsthand knowledge as to whether agency actually existed, the only actual competent evidence, because there was no signed and sworn affidavit filed with the briefings, there was no evidentiary hearing, it's that actual return of service.
And is there any case law that allows in Michigan that allows the individual officers, whether they're sued individually or in their official capacity, to be served by serving the chief of police of their jurisdiction? Is there, I mean, we're trying to figure out Michigan law here.
Sure. I can tell you that I did do a due diligence search, and I wasn't able to find case law specifically on point in Michigan. I will say that the Department of Justice in the federal sector clearly has rules that states that you can serve chief officer if you're suing someone in their official capacity. I will also say that I am not familiar with any case law that establishes that even though the plaintiff does have the burden at a 12b-5 motion to establish that service of process was complete, that once they provide competent substantial evidence, that burden should shift over to the defense, and at which point the defense has to actually rebut that competent substantial evidence. So I would suggest that just providing the actual service, which does allege, and the court seems to actually, the trial court seems to accept that it alleges at least facially alleges an agency relationship that they are lawfully entitled to accept on behalf.
What is on the face of it? I mean, on the face of it is that I delivered the papers to this person. That doesn't really establish that person was lawfully able to accept service, does it?
That's an excellent point, and I'll kind of shift over and address that in by talking about due diligence. The trial court speaks about due diligence, right? That's required. On the face of the document, you have the actual acting chief of police at that time, the chief law enforcement officer signing the document, accepting service, knowingly, voluntarily accepting, saying, I will sign on behalf of my law enforcement officers who are being served in their official capacities, right? So here's what we know for sure in this case. The defendants in this case were identified as active law enforcement officers for the Department of East Lansing. They know that they were sued in their individual as well as their official capacities, that the plaintiffs hired a process server who is an officer capable of serving process.
I understand all that, but I guess it comes down to the theory about whether under the public corporation service statute that applies to an individual. And, you know, Judge Moore's already asked you about that. But if you look at that ex ante, I don't think you look at that and say, oh, that's going to be okay. I mean, there's some more diligence required, isn't there?
Well, so the due diligence,
say,
right?
Okay, hey, here you go. Okay, I'll take it. That's it. I mean, that can't be the end of it. You're taking a risk when you do that, aren't you?
Sure. Well, I would suggest that there was. So this is what happened. They hired a process server. They didn't just have their friend serve somebody. That process server went into the East Lansing Police Department. They didn't serve the first cadet that they saw there. They didn't serve the front desk. They actually made an inquiry. They actually spoke with these are facts that I don't believe are in dispute. I actually spoke with the deputy chief, and the deputy chief signed that document. So when he signs that document, he's saying, I accept service. This isn't just a front desk person saying, yep, you know, Amazon came by, and I signed for a package. This is the chief law enforcement officer for the entire city of East Lansing, and he's saying, yes, I will take service, and he signs it himself. And then you also have the actual signed and filed return of service from the process server, who in the state of Michigan has to be someone capable of actually submitting service of process, and they sign and they swear and they file it with the court.
But if you're an attorney and you're serving someone and you're serving somebody who is basically a best case scenario is an agent, right? You're not serving the person at home. You're serving an agent. Don't you have to make sure that agent is an agent that can accept service? I mean, it's not just, hey, this person is high up in the government and I'm just going to take their word for it. It doesn't seem like enough to me.
Well, I guess the question then becomes, you know, what we have is we are left with the federal statutes, the federal rules, we're left with the Michigan rules, and then you have to look at due diligence. And I guess the problem is that what is actually required at that point, right? If you're trying to establish a factual and a legal question as to whether service is sufficient, then at that point, an evidentiary hearing, an affidavit, a signed and a verified actual motion saying that no agency actually existed would be sufficient to rebut. But what I'm saying is that, well, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Can I ask you a question about the merits? Because I know we're running out of time. can you explain? Most of your claims, it seems to me, if there's probable cause to arrest, that will take care of the claims. And I'm curious what your argument is as to why there wasn't probable cause. I understand the statute is not valid, but at the time, why was there not probable cause?
I would suggest that we're getting into obviously 12B6 range, and I would just like to point out just briefly that I think this order itself was based upon 12B5, but it certainly is relevant. I would suggest that in a 1983 case,
are you saying we could not affirm on that ground?
I believe you could, but I'm just saying that I think the there's plenty to talk about in 12B5 range. But to answer your question directly, because you are entitled to a good and a thoughtful answer, I would suggest that in a 1983 case there is room for the federal court to consider when a statute is facially deficient and an officer knowingly seeks to enforce a facially deficient statute, that there is room in a 1983 case to go forward even if probable cause exists for a facially deficient statute.
Do you have any cases that would support that view?
I don't necessarily have any cases, but I would suggest that there is room for it based upon this statute itself and based upon the actual order that the trial court gave, which clearly establishes that this wasn't just a law that was unconstitutional, it was facially unconstitutional. It would provide for someone who's sleeping in their own house at night to have that house being broken into and have them arrested and pulled out of bed if somebody starts a fire 150 feet away in another house.
Did the facts of this case, I'm curious, the two women who are the plaintiffs here, were they in the parking space of someone when they were taking out their phones and doing whatever they were doing vis-a-vis the fire in the mattress?
We are at the pleading stage, and what I have, of course, is I'm left just as you are with the pleadings themselves. The record that I have establishes that they had just got home from work. They had parked in their licensed parking place.
Their licensed parking space, or was it the boyfriend's or some friend's parking space?
My understanding was that they were at their house, where they their apartment or wherever where they lease, and that's the designated spot for parking.
And the complaint says that they were in the parking space when they were doing the filming?
I believe they just got out of their vehicle.
The statute says if you're in a public space or someone else's private space, but if they were in their own space, then they would be able to stay there. Is that correct?
I would suggest that not only is that correct, but that would also defeat the probable cause argument upon which this case was.
That's why I was asking you, how did that impact on probable cause?
I think Your Honor is very intuitively and very thoughtfully pointed that out. That's my time.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Josephine DiLorenzo on behalf of defendants. I think our brief says everything we need it to say, so I'll just try to highlight the main points. And the district court did focus on the merits. And the first was the probable cause issue. There are several counts that are based on allegations of Fourth Amendment violations, including unlawful seizure, unlawful detention, and malicious prosecution. And as you were just discussing, probable cause is an element of all of those. And so our position is that those claims are properly dismissed because the plaintiffs failed to adequately plead facts alleging a lack of probable cause. I would point out that
could they be arrested under that then applicable statute if they were in their own parking space?
The plain language of the statute does say the unenclosed private property of another, but I believe that the complaint said that they had parked their cars, but then they were near, so I don't know that they were standing in their actual parking space, but I believe that it would still be probable cause because they were within 300 feet of the fire and they didn't see that.
Yeah, but if hypothetically the complaint could be read to say that they were in their own parking space, then wouldn't it be not within the statute to arrest them?
If it was their own, I guess you'd have to say it says the private property of another, but if they were leasing it, I don't know. We might have to parse the words like that. But it did seem that they were, they got out of their cars. So I don't know if they were standing like right in their parking space. So, and then they didn't prove that they didn't allege any facts to say that they met any of the exceptions in that statute, which were that they were either trying to put it out or they had permission to be there.
So under the statute, let's take away my concern about the parking space.
Okay.
Under the statute, if they were simply trying to call 911, they would be in violation of the statute?
I believe so, because it's very specific in that you're trying to put out the fire. So to me, that's like actively trying to put out the fire. And they didn't. I think that standing there calling someone isn't the same as actively trying to put it out. And again, I mean, this was found to be unconstitutional, so I'm not trying to defend the law, but that's what it said. Right. And then we also have additional reasons, well, for the excessive force claim, because obviously probable cause isn't an element of that, and that's barred by the 3-year statute of limitations. And that's actually an additional reason to dismiss the unlawful arrest claims as well, because the plaintiffs were arrested on October 17th, 2015, but they didn't file their initial complaint, the one that was defective and because it was unsigned, until October 18th, 2018.
Do we look at the date of arrest, or do we look at the date of arraignment under the Supreme Court's case Wallace versus Quito?
I believe that was the time of arrest. So we cited two cases for that. One was from this case, and or one was from this court, and was from the Supreme Court.
I may be wrong, but I thought Wallace versus Quito said, in a false arrest case which is followed by criminal proceedings, the statute begins to run at the time the claimant becomes detained pursuant to legal process.
You might be right. I might have written it wrong in our brief, but I thought it was the time of arrest. That's what we were going by on that.
But that would make a difference here factually.
That could make a difference for the arrest claim, but not the excessive force claim. And then there was the count labeled right to resist unlawful arrest, which we discussed how that's not actually a cognizable cause of action under Michigan law. It's a defense to resist the criminal charge of resisting arrest. And then there's the municipal and supervisory liability claims, which I don't think plaintiffs discussed in their briefs, so I would just rely on the arguments in our brief for that. And then And then as to the individual defendants, there's the service of process issue.
Yeah, so the service of process issue is sort of interesting. If we have individual police officers who are sued in their individual and official capacities, why wouldn't the chief of police be an appropriate agent to receive service of process for their supervisees?
Well, for the individual claims, so we're not disputing that the city itself, which would be the police department, so that would be the official capacity claims, we're not disputing that. It's for the individuals, for the claims against them as individuals. There wasn't any law, there's no law that says that the deputy chief is the agent that, you know, plaintiffs didn't cite any. So there's no law or evidence to show that they were actually, that deputy chief was actually appointed.
Well, suppose somebody hypothetically is suing individual police officers, and you don't have hypothetically an ability to find out where they live, and so you go to the place where they work, and I'm making all of this up, okay? So hypothetically, the most senior person at the police station or in the police department says, I will accept service on behalf of these officers. And the reason why the police chief does this is they don't want a process server trying to run amok finding police officers at their homes. Isn't it appropriate in my hypothetical for the plaintiff here to be able to rely on the hypothetical statement by the chief, I will accept service of process for these individual officers so you don't have to go to their home?
Well, hypothetically,
yes.
It might be, and it might be something that this court needs to weigh in on, because the case law that we cited, there are district court cases in the circuit that said a representation like that is not good enough. And those were only district court cases.
But, right, because those were district court cases.
Yep.
Right.
So it might be something that this court hasn't weighed in on. But I guess usually when these service of process, it's not just a technicality. It's related to due process, and you have to follow the rules.
Right, because the problem, on the other hand, would be that these officers might not know that they had been sued, because maybe that person accepting service would throw the materials into the trash can instead of actually giving it to the defendants. But it sounds like, and I know I'm drawing out this hypo extremely long, but it sounds like this would be something that the district court could have a hearing on.
Oh, on whether?
On whether it was appropriate to serve the police chief and whether there were any representations made that the police chief would give the service to, give the process to the defendants, the individual defendants, and so on.
Well, I don't know that it's an evidentiary issue at this point. If the case law that we have right now, albeit only district court cases, is saying that that's not good enough. And there is also the Chief Murphy didn't work there anymore at the time. So it was only those two, Parks and Swab, that were employees. So we still have the issue of the third one.
So was Murphy ever served?
I don't believe that he was. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think so.
But Murphy was sued only in his supervisory capacity, right? And as part of the Monell claim.
I thought he was individual as well.
Was he? Okay.
I believe so.
But was, I mean, he wasn't involved in this, was he?
No. Just, we discussed just, that in our in the brief that he, yeah, he wasn't part of the arrest, and then there weren't any other allegations that he approved or looked the other way. The last issue was the good cause and whether you have to go beyond that. The district court found that there wasn't good cause because of the lack of due diligence. And we also pointed out that, well, there was the initial complaint that was defective, and also that the plaintiffs actually had noticed as of December 19th, 2018, that their case would be dismissed if they didn't timely complete service. But they waited until the day before to try to figure everything out. And so I guess plaintiff's point is that even though the district court found that there was no good cause, it had to engage in an additional analysis. Well, even though there's no good cause, maybe I'm still going to exercise my discretion. And courts, the district courts in this circuit do engage in additional analysis, but there were several examples from this court, and I cited those on page 47 and 48 of my brief, where this court just looked and the district court said there's no good cause, we dismissed the case, and this court affirmed with no additional discussion. So I don't know that it was required that
this case, the judge seemed to say, she seemed to recognize that she
yes.
had the discretion,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm, she did.
But then she uses the word good cause again,
yep.
which I take to mean not in the technical 4M sense. It seemed like she meant, I don't have any reason to exercise this other discretion, but I don't know. I obviously wasn't there, but I'm reading the transcript. It looks like she acknowledges the discretion. So to the extent it might be a legal error not to acknowledge the discretion, I think she acknowledges
she
that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Okay.
She did.
And then she just says, I'm not going to exercise my extra discretion,
right.
I guess.
Is she that couldn't get past the lack of due diligence, I guess. She just focused on that. But, yeah, she did acknowledge that she could have exercised her discretion, and she didn't. So I don't think that's, you know, even if she didn't address all five factors on the record, like, I don't think that's a reason for reversal.
But would this idea of, hey, I should be able to serve the deputy chief or whatever, I don't want, you know, they clearly don't want me rooting around to find cops' addresses, whatever. Would that be part of the consideration of whether you should extend the time if I made that, you know, let's say it's a mistake because they can't accept service legally under Michigan law. Is that still something that the judge can take into account on whether to extend the time?
I suppose she could. I know there were five specific factors. Some of them had to do, well, would the case, you know, be thrown out on statute of limitations, which we think it would be, even if.
Yeah, but the factors are just, I mean.
Right, I mean, there's whatever, probably.
Right?
They're
not probably, written down anywhere, right? Yeah. I mean, they're in the, you know, there's a Michigan opinion on it. There's a, you know, there's the Wise opinion, whatever, from the Southern District of Ohio. So, I mean, there are district courts that have all that. But I don't know that the circuit has ever said specifically that there are these factors, right? Have I missed something?
I didn't see anything. And like I said, I found the cases where this court just said, okay, no good cause. That's it.
Have we ever specifically acknowledged that dismissal, or I'm sorry, that you can extend the time even if there isn't good cause?
Well, I believe that's in the plain language of the statute.
Yeah, but I can't remember. I think it's the Fourth Circuit that still says no. Is that? I mean, it's an implica- I guess it's implied by this by the rule, but
it's implied
not
because
explicit.
It says may, I believe.
If you don't know, that's fine. I haven't seen one, but I'm curious whether maybe I missed one.
I don't think that I saw anything in my research, and of course, I was just focusing on trying to see, you know, the factors if this court required you to consider those factors, and I think it's just.
One of the factors is whether it would make a difference from a statute of limitations.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right. I take it your argument is it doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter because they filed a day late, no matter what.
Yep. For most of those. Correct. And then we had our probable.
Well, the excessive force, maybe not the arrest claims, but the.
The excessive force for sure, and then we would have the we have the probable cause argument anyway. Well, I guess that doesn't relate to the statute of limitations. There was something also about is this a pattern, and we kind of pointed out that the initial complaint had all the issues with it. So this is like a pattern of not following the rules, and also again that they had notice. They got a notice a month before, but they still waited till the day before to try to figure everything out. So. That would be reasons for the court to not exercise any additional discretion. So that's all I have, unless you have any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Oh boy, how do you get through everything in 5 minutes? Let's find out. The first thing I'd like to address is, in fact, the probable cause issue. Obviously, at this pleading stage, all facts are given in light, most favorable, and, in fact, are accepted as true at this early pleading stage. As you can see in the actual effective complaint, it's alleged that the officer made no time or attempt to determine whatsoever where the plaintiffs were standing. He immediately saw the plaintiffs, and he charged at them. He hollered at them, he blindsided one of them, drove them into the ground, put them in handcuffs, and drove them away. Based upon the plain reading of the complaint and all favorable implications, I would suggest that there's no time whatsoever for any kind of a probable cause determination or inquiry as to whether they were standing on someone else's license area or whether they were standing on their own. So even if, in fact, they were standing on someone else's.
What does the complaint say? What is the allegation in the complaint?
The complaint says that they just got home from work. They stepped out of their vehicles after having parked in a licensed parking spot. They saw a fire, and they immediately went to contact the non-emergency line for the fire department. So I would suggest that the complaint actually provides an additional attack on whether there was probable cause to the extent that certainly you could constructively say and reasonably and intuitively say that contacting the fire department would in fact be a way for someone to try to fight a fire. Certainly, there's no policy reason to force someone to put their own fire out themselves if they believe that putting out a fire would be appropriately done by people who are trained in doing so. So to that extent, I would also make an argument that as it relates to service of process, again, service of process was actually obtained. It was later determined to be insufficient. And it was later determined to be insufficient after a full briefing on it, after the court had lots of time in order to consider it, and after the court decided that even after a full briefing and an extended period of time that they wanted to have a hearing on the matter as well. So I would suggest that as far as it relates to good cause for not obtaining effective service of process, if you're operating under colorable return of service, and the first opportunity that you have to make to cure any kind of defect in the actual service that was obtained is when the court makes a legal and or factual determination that it was defective, then at that point you have good cause to at least try before the case is dismissed with prejudice. And even failing that, I would suggest that there is, based upon the reading of the statute and based upon the district court treatment, a requirement to actually go through that five-part test, that second prong of service of process. And the only case that is presented before...
I mean, what would the rule be, though, if you're kind of in the neighborhood, if you're close enough and the judge has to have a hearing and you have to do all this stuff and then... The judge ultimately determines that that service was insufficient, that it would be an abuse of discretion not to extend the time at that point because you were close enough.
Well, so I would say that there would appropriately probably be a distinction between service of process that was half-hearted and never obtained, like in the case of Garner v. City of Memphis, versus someone who actually is operating under the color of return of service from an actual person who's situated to actually effectuate that service. And at that point, if there's a colorable argument on both sides and the judge is calling balls and strikes, then it would be appropriate for the judge to say, okay, you relied on this, I made a determination that it wasn't effective, so now you have a reasonable ability to cure.
But it seems discretionary to me, at least on the good cause, on the absence of good cause. And so she's already operating under this idea that there was not good cause. At that point, an exercise of discretion seems, unless it's something completely beyond the pale, I don't know why we wouldn't just, go along with that.
Well, I mean, obviously this is part of the rule, so you have to look at the actual statutory intention. Obviously, the statute provides five different analyses, and so I would say that if you're in football and you have two downs to make a first down in order to proceed with your offense, right? And the first down you get sacked, all right. So there's no good cause, right? The second down, if you have a second down and it's provided for you, and there's five different plays that you can call on second down, if the quarterback just says, "Well, we got sacked on first down, so forget about second down because we already got sacked on first down," it just doesn't make sense. There was the judge actually articulated and said, "Yeah, there is a five-part test." Then the judge decided not to go into any of that five-part test because she just adopted the first determination on that first prong.
It seems to me that she acknowledged that she had the discretion, she recognized that there's a five-part test, and then she made a decision. It doesn't mean you're suggesting it means that she didn't really think about the factors or didn't. I mean, that suggests to me that she knew what they were, or she is a judge in that district where they have that test. I don't think she has to go through each one of the factors, does she? Again, it's discretionary. Who knows? The factors are not in the statute. I mean, the district court have come up with those factors, I think. So I don't know.
Yeah, Your Honor, I mean, we do live in common law. So what you do is you look at the past to figure out what should be done in the present so that everyone has an expectation of how law gets done. Clearly, there's five different tests that are required. It's not just I'm using my discretion, but the judge is supposed to go through each of those five tests and apply a reasoning, a balancing based upon those five tests. I would suggest that unlike Garner v. the City of Memphis, where no argument, no matter how talented or skillful you are as an appellate attorney, could be made, that it would fall, any one of those tests would fall on the side of the plaintiff. In this case, the plaintiff has significant factors, all of them bending toward the plaintiff's case, in the plaintiff's favor in this case, and as a result, that should be the way that it's handled. I will also suggest that if this esteemed panel looks at the facts and says, I'm not sure what the judge was thinking and what the judge actually ruled on, the appropriate thing to do would be to say, okay, we'll remand it back down. Let's get the actual judge's take on this. Let's get a good record, and then we can look at that record and meaningfully make a decision at the appellate level.
Thank you. Thank you both for your argument. The case will be submitted, and the clerk may adjourn court.